Welcome to the University of Michigan Press podcast, featuring interviews with University of Michigan Press authors. Classical Spies is the first insider's account of the operations of the American Intelligence Service in World War II Greece. Initiated by archaeologists in Greece and the Eastern Mediterranean, the network drew on scholars' personal contacts and knowledge of languages and terrain. While modern readers might think Indiana Jones is just a fantasy character, Classical Spies discloses events where even Indy would feel at home, burying Athenian dig records in an Egyptian tomb, activating prep school connections to establish spies codenamed Vulture and Chickadee, and organizing parachute drops. Susan Hoyk Allen reveals remarkable details about a remarkable group of individuals. Often mistaken for mild-mannered professors and scholars, such archaeologists as Princeton's Rodney Young, Cincinnati's Jack Caskey and Carl Blagan, Yale's Jerry Sperling and Dorothy Cox, and Bryn Mawr's Virginia Grace proved their mettle as effective spies in an intriguing game of cat and mouse with their Nazi counterparts. Relying on interviews with individuals sharing their stories for the first time, previously unpublished secret documents, private diaries and letters, and personal photographs, Classical Spies offers an exciting and personal perspective on the history of World War II. An experienced archaeologist and author of many books and articles, including a volume on Frank Calvert's discovery of Troy, Susan Hoyk Allen has taught at Yale University and Smith College and is currently visiting scholar in the Department of Classics, Brown University. Archaeologists have often been accused of being spies, even when they weren't. Can you talk a little about what drew these people into the world of spying?
Well, the archaeologists that I've been dealing with, they were all real people, but I call them my characters because the story has such drama. They all got involved for different reasons, and they were involved in espionage in World War II for the Office of Strategic Services, which I call the OSS, the World War II predecessor of the CIA. The main reasons they got involved were because they wanted to save the country of Greece, and these were men and women, not just men. They wanted to rid Greece of its Axis occupiers. And we have to remember that this was really an extraordinary time. It was a time of Hitler and Mussolini and really barbaric circumstances. So we have to remember this when we think of why they got involved. They were chosen because they had special expertise in language, and they knew the land, they knew the topography, all of this really specialized knowledge that they'd acquired over years and years and years. They were really anxious and thrilled that they could put it to use to save the country of Greece. And frankly, they were happy to get out of the classroom. You know, they're happy to get away from classroom routine and get back into the field. Most archaeologists love being in the field. They love digging, and these individuals were no different. And they thought originally when they signed on that they would be using archaeology as their cover, and they would actually be digging while engaging in espionage, or what they called it then was spooking. And this was really glamorous for them. So some of them were seduced by the glamour of it. Eventually, they went out to their posts not using archaeology as cover, but instead they went out as relief workers and U.S. government military attachés, representatives of the U.S. Land Lease Administration, which allowed the United States government to lend foreign countries all kinds of military aid and equipment without jeopardizing our neutrality. And they also went with the Office of War Information, which was sort of a PR or press corps. Although the archaeologists returned to their classroom within about a year of the end of the war, at least one retained involvement in government offices, intelligence, and remained involved in government employ long into the Cold War. When I began my research, certain individuals at the American School of Classical Studies at Athens, which I have been involved with for, let's see, at least 30 years, expressed some concern about the book and the danger of tainting archaeologists as spies. Archaeologists have always been, or often, I should say, been employed as spies. The British and the Germans used archaeology as cover long before World War II. And in recent years, foreign governments have used archaeologists and anthropologists for espionage and intelligence purposes. And this is a really hot subject within the American Anthropological Association. While ethicists debate the pros and cons of tainting the profession, the American military has recently embedded anthropologists with troops in Iraq, and the Archaeological Institute of America has endeavored to educate the military, the soldiers going over, about cultural property issues in the areas where they serve in order to lessen wartime destruction. And this is a takeoff from the World War II monuments group, where they went in with Patton and instructed Patton about buildings where he shouldn't detonate explosives, etc. So whether or not American archaeologists are actually involved in espionage at present is unclear. But if they're good at their jobs, we'll never know.
What were the valuable qualities that the archaeologists brought to espionage?
To answer that question, I'd like to quote the words of the boss of the Athens station of OSS in 1945. He was assessing the qualities of Trojan archaeologist Jerome Sperling, who gathered intelligence from all parts of Greece, particularly eastern Macedonia and Thrace, from 1944 to 1946, where his proficiency in Turkish and Greek proved most valuable. His boss rated his performance superior and his work really outstanding. I think the important thing to remember here is that many of the qualities deemed exceptional are those of a good field archaeologist. And I quote, "As a secret intelligence operative, Major Sperling's production has always been large and almost always of high quality. As time passed and he gained experience, his reports became still better. His preciseness, his objectivity, his logical development of ideas, and his clarity of expression all combined to enhance the value of the intelligence which he obtained as a result of his highly alert and inquiring mind. His intellectual honesty, his great attention to detail, his indefatigable willingness to work, and his readiness to expose himself to discomfort, if not to danger. There can be no doubt that Major Sperling has proved to be much the best secret intelligence operative we have had in Greece since the liberation. He has produced far more than any other operative, and his reports have been generally of higher caliber than those submitted by others. In addition to his accomplishments as a secret intelligence operative, Major Sperling has throughout given ample evidence of an exceptionally cooperative spirit, a capacity for teamwork, which has included the ability to subordinate himself gracefully to others of lesser rank, and the greatest conscientiousness and devotion to duty." I think all of the qualities highlighted by the head of the Athens station of the OSS with regard to Sperling are exactly the qualities of an excellent archaeologist.
The American School of Classical Studies at Athens features prominently in your book, as you've said, and of course the school has a long history of supporting the culture and citizens of Greece. If there hadn't been such a school in Athens, what do you think the effect might have been on Allied operations in the area?
Well, the American School of Classical Studies at Athens, first of all, has been the research home for U.S. citizens in Greece since 1881. So it has provided U.S. citizens with a base of conducting research and study, a hospital, meeting place. It has beautiful gardens in the back, and it provides administrative support for American excavations in Greece. So this is a sort of picture of what the institution provides. Although it's not a formal tool of American diplomacy, as its sister institutions are, for instance, the German Archaeological Institute and the French counterpart, the American School is the preeminent American institution in Greece, and at least one of its former leaders served as the U.S. minister or ambassador to Greece. So there are ties. If there hadn't been a school, I think the most important lack would have been the ability to mount a coordinated, cooperative endeavor in Greece with people with language experience, experience with the land, etc., able to function as a cohesive network. There were a number of American institutions other than the American School, also in Greece at the time, businesses, etc., but they didn't have this sort of stable of highly intelligent individuals able to hit the ground running like the American School provided. American citizens in Greece during the time of World War II would have had no rallying point if the American School hadn't been there. After all the diplomats took off, there were several months when the school was the only institution there for them, and the Greeks would have lacked a tangible symbol of hope during the horrific years of the Axis occupation. Although there were other organizations and institutions in addition to businesses in Greece that where American spies could have been recruited, I think they didn't have the topographic knowledge that the archaeologists had, and they didn't have the qualities of observation that archaeologists are trained to exhibit. And again, the fact that they were a unified group, a coherent, cooperative, working unit, I think is really critical. In a wartime OSS blueprint for post-war intelligence in Greece, archaeologists suggested various American educational institutions and businesses throughout Greece as deep cover for American intelligence operatives in the post-war period. And for a decade during the Cold War, one OSS archaeologist served as director of the American School of Classical Studies at Athens. But as far as we know, all CIA officers were housed at the U.S. Embassy as special assistants to the ambassador.
Your work documents many conspicuous acts of bravery by Greek citizens. Are there any that especially struck you as exceptional?
Well, the one who stands out hands down is Cleo Atacides, a remarkable, remarkable woman whom I was really privileged to know, really privileged. She was trained as a concert pianist in Athens. She left her comfortable life in Athens to nurse Greek soldiers fighting in Albania, where the Greeks, against all odds, were successfully driving back the forces of an Italian invasion that had begun on October 28, 1940. So the Italians invaded Greece without provocation, and Greece, a tiny country, under-equipped, outnumbered, after France, Belgium, Holland, all these other countries had capitulated, Greece fought back, and it fought back really valiantly. All the other European countries had been overrun by the Axis juggernaut, and it was the Greeks who stood up to the Italians, chasing them out of Greece and back into Albania from whence they had attacked Greece. And so while the Greek soldiers were in Albania, Cleo and her mother-in-law and various members of the family manned these Red Cross huts. I say manned them. They were all women doing this. Imagine women out in the snow by themselves treating soldiers. Really heroic work. Cleo's husband was a pilot. He was flying reconnaissance missions for the Greek Air Force, while Cleo, all alone in a little wooden hut in the freezing snow-deep mountains of Albania, was giving first aid to soldiers who were dying of exposure. She exhibited frostbite. She lost toes to frostbite. She suffered along with the soldiers. And all this time, she was assisted by an American archaeologist who drove an ambulance and delivered supplies to her and the other women manning these huts along the front. So Cleo exhibits all of the characteristics of real courage that the Greeks collectively exhibited in their response to the Italian invasion. Their response was one of passionate courage, not only from heroic soldiers, but also civilians like Cleo, who after surviving the later battles of Crete and El Alamein, ended up working with the American archaeologists in Cairo before returning to Greece with them.
The Greeks have long had a love of boats, right back to the Odyssey and Jason and the Argonauts. Could you talk a little about the important role boats played in pro-Greek activities?
Well, you've mentioned several of the myths and legends that preserve stories of harrowing voyages undertaken by Greek heroes in the remote past. Navigation has always been dangerous in the unpredictable Aegean and Mediterranean waters surrounding Greece. Greece is a country that is made up of hundreds of islands, so sea travel was always essential for the Greeks. It wasn't a matter of luxury, it was absolutely essential. So for millennia, the Greeks have had to take to the sea to communicate with their countrymen and seek out other civilizations, like ancient Egypt, to trade for precious commodities. So the Greeks have long been excellent seamen with a long history of navigation. When the Nazis occupied Greece, Greek sailors posing as fishermen defied death to ferry spies and weapons into Greece. They evacuated Jews and British soldiers who were marooned in Greece and subject to death. They brought food and medical supplies back from the coast of Turkey to their starving countrymen. And they sailed little fishing boats, very small boats, called kaikis, little Greek fishing boats, the only form of transportation that was not totally suspect to the Germans. Some of these had motors. All of them had sails. The sails were convenient when the motors conked out, which they frequently did. The Greeks had to sail and rely on the technology they'd had for millennia. The Greek sailors usually traveled at night, navigating by the stars, and they moored next to uninhabited crags or pulled up on shore and hid their boats under the beech trees by day. And while they slept, they had their vessels camouflaged by nets.
Many talented individuals died on both sides in the Greek theater. Who were some of the bigger losses and why?
Well, the greatest casualties were those of Greek civilians. Thousands of Greeks during the war starved to death, especially in 1941 and 42. The Germans killed thousands of Greek Jews from Thessaloniki at Auschwitz in 1943. Other Greeks died fighting in various resistance factions that quickly grew up throughout Greece in the wake of the Nazi invasion on April 9, 1941. So the greatest casualties were the civilians themselves. Americans only arrived in Greece in 1943, and they were non-combatants, so they suffered few losses there. Those involved with the OSS and secret intelligence who were killed died from friendly fire when they were shot by their British allies. By contrast, the British, because Greece was part of the Mediterranean theater, and that was controlled by the British, the Middle East theater was controlled by the British, so there were far more British involved in Greece throughout the war. The British had fought openly in Greece since 1941, and they'd marooned many of their soldiers there in the course of several evacuations. Some British archaeologists took part in special operations, while others engaged in espionage like their American cousins. Of these, the most prominent to die was John Pendlebury, an athletic Oxonian, Oxford man, who dug for a decade as a right-hand man of Sir Arthur Evans at Knossos on Crete, and was the excavator of Tell el Amarna in Egypt. As the British vice consul in Crete, Pendlebury organized the Cretan resistance just in case the island was ever invaded. And when invasion came on May 20, 1941, his Cretan trainees fought valiantly and continued their heroic resistance throughout the war. Their teacher, Pendlebury, on the other hand, was captured by the Germans on the very first day of the invasion of Crete and summarily executed. He was betrayed by his glass eye. Because Pendlebury, he was a hiker, and whenever he would leave his glass eye on the desk, and people would know that he'd gone out and he was coming back. That was his sort of code for the people he worked with. And he was the only archaeologist working in Greece with a glass eye, and the Germans, they were very intelligent. And so when they caught this fellow who was missing an eye, immediately they knew it was Pendlebury, and they executed him.
So why do you think so many of those involved in World War II spy operations around Greece didn't talk much about it in later years?
Well, that's an interesting question. And I can say that when they joined the OSS, every single individual employed by the OSS signed an oath to the U.S. government swearing never to divulge information about their clandestine actions. So they all signed a very serious oath. They took this quite seriously. They kept everything hush-hush throughout the war, even after the war, were very silent with people who had not been involved. During the Cold War, as Greece became a strategic bulwark between the Free West and Soviet Eastern Europe, and the United States began to engage more directly in Greek affairs than it had done during the war, public perceptions of espionage in post-war United States and Greece underwent a paradigm shift. So what had been thought of as heroic and was in fact heroic patriotic work during World War II was looked at quite differently during the Cold War because of various operations that the CIA had been involved with. Throughout this period, the archaeologists kept quiet about their heroic and patriotic war work. There are numerous reasons for this, but I think you can boil it down to the fact that they took this oath, which they still considered very seriously in the first decade of the 21st century. So after 3 decades, most spoke about it only obliquely and then very reluctantly. I tracked down and contacted almost all of those who were still alive and had participated in these events. Many still felt bound by the oath they had taken more than 50 years earlier, and only with great difficulty did I convince them to tell me stories which they had told me they planned to take to the grave. One exception to this rule is the reason that I got involved with this subject in the first place. And that was one night at ouzo hour on the island of Chaea, a Greek island affectionately known as Chaos, which was its ancient name, and it's somewhat appropriate even today, although it's a sleepy island with a beautiful yacht harbor, emerald clear waters because of the green rock of the island. One night at ouzo hour, when I was working with my professor, John Caskey, Jack Caskey, we're all sitting back, tossing back an ouzo, and Mr. Caskey joined the crowd and began to tell a story of one episode of his war that involved a particular spy by the name of Cicero, who had infiltrated the British embassy in Ankara, Turkey. And Caskey, amazingly to me, because I'd only seen him in tweed during the year, and even on the island of Chaea, he was a very, well, quiet and seemingly conservative individual. So at this night at ouzo hour, as the sun is setting over the rocky spines of the island, and you can see the colors changing all the way to the Peloponnese in southern Greece, Caskey began to hold forth about rescuing this German double agent, this beautiful blonde, and I began to see him in a totally different light. And he was in charge of rescuing her by Kaiki in the moonlight. So this was the seed for my book. And I was a dirt archaeologist. I excavated in Israel. I worked in Turkey, Crete, Cyprus, and several places in Greece for about a decade, excavating myself. And then I became more interested in the history of archaeology and the people involved in the excavations. And so one day I was in Washington, and I was going to the National Archives, which I call my candy store because they're so full of wonderful things. And I had a shopping list of things that I could begin to work on. I had just finished one book. I was thinking about getting involved with another one, and I thought, well, why don't I see what Caskey did during the war? Because I thought he was a grunt. I thought he was, just a very small fry. I was really wrong. I was really wrong. So that was the beginning of the book, was that night at ouzo hour back in 1978, and I picked up the thread again in the 21st century and went at it.
Dr. Allen, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
We have been speaking with Dr. Susan Hoik Allen, author of Classical Spies, American Archaeologists with the OSS in World War II Greece. To learn more about our books, visit us on the web at press.umich.edu. This podcast has been brought to you by the University of Michigan Press, all rights reserved.